Monster Man, Special Episode, Rakshasa. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Or at least, that's what I normally do on this show, but this is a special episode of Monster Man. This episode is brought to you courtesy of the generosity of my Patreon backers, and specifically of Patreon backer Dave Noonan. Like everyone who backs at the $5 level, Dave was entitled to choose a subject for his own special episode, and he asked me to talk about... Well, actually, he gave me a choice. He said I could either do Mind Flayers or Rakshas, and I decided to do the Rakshas, but I really had to think about it. You know, Mind Flayers, interesting in their own way, and maybe a little bit different from the usual monster that I talk about, which is something kind of grounded in folklore and mythology, but in the end, I decided to go for the Rakshasa. Now, I have previously discussed this monster. It was back in episode 51, Rakshas to Rat, Giant, parentheses, Sumatran. But of course, that was only for a few minutes, so I'm going to start with that. I'm going to start with the things that I discussed in that episode and then go into more detail and maybe talk about some ways in which to maybe use this monster in a D&D campaign. So let's get started. Okay, to recap what I talked about back in episode 51. First, the official D&D pronunciation guide says Rakshasa, but every other source that I found says it's Rakshas, or Rakshasa. The feminine form is Rakshasi. The Rakshas is a creature from Indian mythology. It appears in both Hindu and Buddhist writings, and they probably most prominently appear as antagonists in the Indian epics, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. The most famous of them is probably Ravana, the king of Lanka, who is a giant. Well, he himself is not a giant, actually. He's just a Rakshas with 10 heads, and he's got another brother who is a giant, and yet another brother who, interestingly, is a good guy, and that's something that we're going to be talking about as well. Rakshasas are described in a bunch of different ways, usually with a kind of non-specifically frightening appearance, and I think we can generally say that they have kind of what we would think of as like an ogre or a vampire kind of appearance. So they have prominent fangs or tusks, they may have claws, they have frightening staring eyes, and they're often kind of weird colors, and they just generally have a monstrous and frightening visage. They're kind of bestial. And in fact, early editions of Dungeons & Dragons mimic this, but the illustration for the Rakshasa by Dave Trompier was so influential that they gradually became Tiger Men. Right? That originally the idea was they are beastly. Here's an example of one such beast in the form of a tiger, and then we came to accept them all as tiger-like. The main trait of the Rakshas is that it is a man-eater. They're defined by their hunger. In fact, when they were created, Brahma created them, and they were so full of bloodlust and hunger that they started eating him, and he shouted out, "Defend me!" And their name, Rakshas, actually comes from a word that means to defend. I think this is a story that explains, you know, the etymology of a name that already existed. So Rakshas means something like that which is to be protected from, that which is to be defended from, you know, a thing that we have to protect ourselves against. Then this myth was created in order to explain that. They are man-eaters, and that might explain why in Dungeons & Dragons, again, they're typically portrayed as tiger-like, you know, because of course we similarly have this idea of the man-eating tiger, and perhaps again because they're creatures from Indian mythology, and we tend to associate tigers with India. In the Monster Manual, they can use both magic user and cleric spells, although they're not as good with the cleric spells, and they also have ESP and illusion powers, so basically they use their ESP to find out what it is that the person they're trying to deceive wants to see, and then their illusion powers to create it. They're immune to low-level magic, they actually just have to be sort of fought up, but they're particularly vulnerable to blessed crossbow bolts. Now, I didn't mention that in the original episode. I've since read that this is basically because of an episode of Kolchak the Night Stalker that had a Rakshas as its enemy, where it was kind of a man-eating monster. And in this episode, the Rakshasa is like cannibal demon, and it uses illusions to appear as someone that the victim trusts, and then in the end, Kolchak kills it by shooting it with a crossbow bolt. So you can see where this idea of the blessed crossbow bolt comes from, and also specifically the idea that the Rakshasa uses its powers to appear as someone that the victim would trust, although that's also present in the Mahabharata. So there are definitely lots of stories where the Rakshasa uses its abilities of illusion to lull the victim into a false sense of security by appearing as someone that they ought to trust, like a little old lady or a holy man or someone like that. The Rakshasa appears in the 1977 Monster Manual, but that is not the first time that it appeared. In fact, I think it first appeared in an issue of The Strategic Review, which is a kind of predecessor to Dragon magazine. That was in 1975, and this Kolchak the Night Stalker episode comes out in 1974, and I believe Gary Gygax did say that that episode was kind of what inspired him to include the Rakshasa in Dungeons & Dragons. So I think the timeline there is a pretty good one. And that telling detail of the crossbow bolt, which is not, as far as I'm aware, something that's actually in the mythology, although Ravana is killed by a thrown weapon, but I don't think it's a crossbow. So it was present in popular culture. So with its powers and its magical abilities, the Rakshasa is obviously not just a fight monster, right? It is primarily a deceiver. And that puts it into a... You know, it's more of a murderer that you have to catch if you want to just have it killing people. You know, it's definitely something that tricks people and cons them. And it certainly would make sense that it would have kind of minions who had similarly been deluded. I wouldn't prefer to have others do most of its fighting for it, right? That seems like a reasonable option if you're a Rakshasa. Strategically and even narratively, I feel like the Rakshasa plays some of the same role that maybe a vampire would in your game, right? It's a villain whose identity you have to uncover, and then you battle your way through its minions, and then you kill it. But actually, killing it is not necessarily like the terrible big stand-up fight that you would get with, say, going to go slay a dragon. Although, mind you, it could be with a vampire, except presumably you're, you know, opening the vampire's crypt in the daytime and just hammering a stake through its heart, right? There are, in fact, some sources which suggest that the Rakshasa's powers become greater at night. But I also think that Rakshasas as villains fit well into a certain aesthetic that is similar to, but different enough from, the one that you get with vampires. And this goes back to the idea of their eating people as well. Eating people is obviously a villainous and monstrous thing to do, but I do think that it's important to consider the Rakshasas in kind of their cultural and religious context. Now, I know I've said that they appear in Hindu and Buddhist mythology, but one thing that both of those have in common is that they are systems of belief where desire for worldly pleasures is seen as being a harmful and dangerous thing. And we can see the bloodthirstiness of the Rakshasa as an indictment of greed and gluttony in general. And I think that this comes through very clearly in the character of Ravana in the Ramayana. And I'm going to read a short extract here. In this part of the Ramayana, Ravana, who's the baddie in the Ramayana, has kidnapped Sita, the wife of the protagonist, Rama. And Rama's ally, Hanuman, the monkey, not the monkey king, which is Sugriva, but just the monkey hero, I guess, is searching for her, and he has snuck into Ravana's palace and is scampering about doing monkey stuff, you know, climbing up the pillars and so on and so forth, and looking for Sita. And eventually he will, in fact, find her. But early on, we see all these kind of depictions of Ravana's splendor, and they include some descriptions of Ravana. I'm going to start with them. So Hanuman sneaks into Ravana's chambers within the palace, and the first thing he sees is Ravana sleeping on his bed, and he's surrounded by all of his wives, and there's a lengthy description of how they're all beautiful and so on and so forth. And then it says, and this is quite interesting, I think, with Ravana peacefully asleep, it seemed as if the golden lamps watched over these splendid women with fixed, unblinking eyes. There were women there from the families of royal sages, daityas, gandharvas, and rakshasas, and they had all come to Ravana out of love. None had been carried away against her will. They had all been won over by Ravana's personality. None had ever loved another or been the wife of another, none except Sita, the daughter of Janaka. Each of Ravana's wives was nobly born, beautiful, skilled in the arts of pleasure, and extremely desirable. And the monkey, who had only worthy thoughts, said to himself, "How lucky Rama would be if his wife was like the wives of the Rakshasa king!" Then he grew very agitated and reminded himself that Sita was far better than these other women, and that the king of Lanka had done a terrible and ignoble thing. So then he sees actually Ravana's bed. Ravana lay upon it, dark as a mighty rain cloud, with red eyes and huge, powerful arms. He wore a cloth of gold and glittering earrings. Anointed with rare red sandal paste, he was like a cloud in the red evening sky with lightning playing upon it. He saw Ravana's mighty arms adorned with bracelets, sturdy as Indra's flagstaff. They were scarred with battle wounds from Airavata's tusks and Vishnu's discus, and his shoulders bore the marks of Indra's thunderbolt. Ravana's shoulders were strong and powerful, his arms mighty, and his fingers were finely shaped right down to their nails. Sturdy as rounded iron clubs and powerful as an elephant's trunk, his arms spread on the bed looked like five-hooded snakes. The same arms that had been lovingly caressed by beautiful women made the gods Gandhavas, Danavas, Panagas, and Yakshas cry out in pain. His golden crown, slightly awry, was studded with pearls and jewels, and his face was illuminated by his glittering earrings. His broad chest was smeared with sandal paste, and his exquisite necklace added to his blazing splendor. A dazzling white cloth, fine and silken, was draped carelessly across his body, and his loins were covered in yellow silk. Ravana breathed like a hissing serpent, and he appeared like a mighty elephant asleep on the banks of the Ganga. Lamps blazed at the four corners of his bed and illuminated him as lightning would a dark cloud. Okay, so here we have an image of Ravana as a splendid figure, right? And note that we're told that he doesn't seem like pretty cruel and evil to his wives. It says none of them was carried away by force. They all fell in love with him because of his wonderful personality. And indeed, there are parts of the story where Ravana appears, you know, brave, generous, noble, etc., etc. Just, he's a bad guy. And so we can see the Rakshasa's illusion powers at work here. That is to say, they're a metaphor for the fact that here's this person who outwardly seems splendid, but in fact is inwardly evil. So that even Ravana's monstrous appearance is part of his general appearance, not necessarily of being horrifying, but of being impressive. And this is explicitly contrasted against the humble piety of his opponents, at least some of the time. So Hanuman searches around the palace. He keeps looking for Sita. He can't find her in the women's quarters. And indeed, he briefly reproaches himself with, you know, looking at these women. He kind of says like, oh, well, this, you know, that's a lustful thing. But then he says, well, you know, I'm looking for a woman. Where else am I going to find her but in the woman's quarters? But obviously she's not there. So he keeps exploring the palace and eventually he finds a little pleasure garden. And there he sees Sita, who is in a state of disarray. Like she hasn't like washed or changed her clothes or anything since she was abducted. And it looks like she's not eating or drinking. You know, she seems to be kind of going on a hunger strike. And she's attended by a bunch of horrible Rakshasa women, or Rakshasis, I guess I should say. And then Ravana turns up. Ten-headed Ravana was woken at that hour by the strains of pleasant music. As he rose, his clothes and garlands in disarray, his first thought was of Sita. Drawn irresistibly to her by his lust, he could not hide his feelings. Adorned with all his jewels and flaunting his majesty, he made straight for the Ashoka Grove. He looked up at the gate. That's Hanuman looked up at the gate, and saw Ravana, whose deeds were unrivaled and whose strength and power were unimaginable. His face was lit up by the sweet-smelling oil lamps that were carried before him. Intoxicated with drink, arrogance, and lust, his red eyes gleaming, Ravana looked like the god of love without his bow. His lovely shawl, white as the froth that was produced when the ocean was churned, had slipped off his shoulders, and he dragged it along behind him carelessly. Hanuman watched in fascination as Ravana, endowed with youth and beauty, entered the garden surrounded by his women, still a little drunk from the night before. This must be Ravana, thought Hanuman, which is funny because he saw him just a few minutes earlier, and climbed higher into the tree. So then he goes on and he starts kind of like trying to woo Sita. He says, beautiful flowers, sandal and priceless unguents, fine clothes, celestial ornaments, the best of food, the softest beds, music, dance, all this can be yours, Sita, if only you would accept me. You are a jewel among women. You cannot stay like this. Accept me and take the best that you deserve. You are young and beautiful, but our youth is passing us by. The past is like a flowing river. It cannot be recaptured. Give up your delusions and become my wife. The jewels and wonderful things I have collected from all the worlds shall be yours, along with my kingdom and myself. I will conquer the whole earth, garlanded with cities, and bestow it upon Janaka just for your sake. There is no one on earth stronger than me. Look how powerful I am. Even the gods and the Asuras cannot face me in battle, for I have trampled upon their fallen battle banners upon the field of war. Adorn yourself with jewels that dazzle and glitter, and let me gaze at your beauty enhanced by these ornaments. Do it as a favor to me, and you can enjoy all the pleasures you like. Eat, drink, make merry, do whatever pleases you. Give away as much wealth as you desire. Think of my wealth, my glory, my majesty. What do you want with Rama, who has to wear rough and simple clothes? Rama has lost all opportunities to be successful. He has renounced his royal splendor and wanders in the forest. He has taken the vows of an ascetic and sleeps on the ground. I wonder if he is even alive. You shall not catch even a glimpse of Rama, for you shall be hidden from view like the moonlight, covered by a thick curtain of rain clouds. And then Sita basically tells him where to go. She says, you know, she loves Rama, and she's married to Rama, and how dare he suggest such an immoral act, and, you know, you cannot tempt me with wealth and power. Do the right thing and give me back to Rama. Make friends with Rama if you wish to keep your position and avoid a horrible death. My husband will rescue me, etc., etc., etc. And then, as we might have expected, Ravana turns nasty. The more a man tries to please a woman, the more he falls into her power, replied Ravana harshly. The more he speaks sweetly, the more she insults him. My love for you makes me hold back my anger, as a good charioteer reins in his horses that have gone off the road. That is the only reason I do not punish you, Sita. Even though you deserve disgrace for being attached to a fake, you deserve a horrible death for all the harsh things you've said to me, Sita. I shall respect the 2-month period I gave you earlier, he continued angrily. But after that, lovely woman, you shall have to share my bed. If you do not take me as a husband at the end of 2 months, you shall be slaughtered in my kitchens for my breakfast. The daughters of the gods and Gandavas who had accompanied Ravana felt sorry for Sita as Ravana bullied and threatened her. They gestured with their eyes and lips and tried to comfort her and express their sympathy. And Sita was somewhat reassured. Obviously, there is no one here who cares enough about you to dissuade you from this disgraceful course of action, she said spiritedly. So, this is a familiar tale, right? But again, we're meant to see that this is showing the hollowness of all of Ravana's worldly glory, right? It's ultimately founded on immoral behavior, which we're supposed to reject. Rama, even though he's living the life of a poor man and, you know, everything looks really bad for him, okay, but, you know, he has the right spirit. His actions are just. And he's pious, whereas Ravana has all the outward trappings of success, but at heart he's a bully and a villain. And his greediness, you know, his wanting to eat Sita up and his wanting to steal Sita away and make her his bride are two sides of the same coin, right? There are two aspects of the same idea. The idea that he is too attached to kind of physical and worldly things. And this makes sense even if you take it and apply it to the D&D Rakshasa, right? That if you think about a tiger, it still has that kind of languid, lazy feeling that we associate with a cat. And so we can imagine that the Rakshasa's desire, you know, its appetite for human flesh and its appetite for kind of splendor and luxury generally make it, you know, mean that it would have all the kind of good trappings that we associate with a boss monster in a Dungeons & Dragons campaign. It should have a palace. You know, it should have, you know, legions of followers and so on. And again, really interesting that humans and sages and gods and families of noble birth and whatever, you know, these people are attracted to Ravana. He's a king. And his retinue is full of, I mean, like, among his wives, yeah, okay, there are Rakshasis, but there are also just women, you know, people who admire his wealth and power and status, and they don't really care if he's a bad guy. Just like in the real world, we can see is full of people who don't care whether someone is particularly nice, as long as they're wealthy and influential and strong and good-looking and so on. So one of the ways that you can really make a Rakshasa a challenge is that you can have him be, I mean, so you can have the bit where the Rakshasa is, you know, in disguise, right? Your sort of low-level Rakshasas appear like that in the Mahabharata. They're just kind of like hanging out in the woods waiting for unsuspecting people to come by so that they can gobble them up. But there should also be Rakshasas who use their powers to appear pleasing to people, but not necessarily to conceal the fact that they are demons or evil spirits, if you prefer. People would just be like, oh yeah, that guy, he's a Rakshasa, but look at his splendid ornaments, look at his wonderful palace. You know, that guy's really got it figured out. He's a great king, and it's a pleasure to, you know, invite him into the family. And here's, you know, your party paladin going, he's a Rakshasa! Have you all lost your minds? But of course, the truth is that there's not all that much difference between a Rakshasa and your common or garden king, right? You know, rulers do brutal and evil things, and they're greedy, and they spend their money on luxury, and, you know, there's a lot of people in the world who would be slumbering on their great crystal bed, wearing silk and jewels, and being smeared with nice smelling sandal paste and being surrounded by beautiful spouses and concubines and eating the best meals and so on and so forth if they thought they could get away with it. And the Rakshas would wind up attracting like-minded people. But there's a further wrinkle, which I mentioned, which is that not all Rakshasas are bad guys. In fact, there are several instances just in the Ramayana alone of sympathetic Rakshasas. The most obvious example of these is Vibhishana, who is Ravana's brother. So in the Ramayana, he turns up while Rama and the army of monkeys are planning, and he says, "I am Vibhishana, the younger brother of Ravana, the wicked king of the Rakshasas. He is the one who abducted Sita, yada yada. She's helpless and miserable. I've argued with Ravana again and again and given him many reasons why he should return Sita to Rama, but he's trapped by his fate and refuses to take my advice. As a man who wants to die refuses medication, he's insulted me and treated me like a slave. So I've renounced my wife and children and have come to Rama for refuge. Rama is the refuge of all creatures in the world. Tell them that Vibhishana has come to see him." So everyone debates about what is to be done. Like, is he a spy from Ravana? Is he... you know, should he be tested? Can they come up with a way to assess his intentions? And Hanuman, who's, you know, basically a good and open-hearted sort, says, "Now, he seemed honest. He seemed like he was telling the truth. And if we investigate him, we would alienate him. And, you know, he could possibly be an ally." And Rama, who is, of course, our hero and, you know, kind of perfect in all things, goes even one better. And he says, "I, too, have something to say on the subject of Vibhishana. Listen to it, for you have my interest at heart. You should never turn away anyone who comes to you in friendship, even if he has evil intentions. A good person would never do that." And then Sugriva says, "Oh, okay, that makes sense. You know, he must be a good person." And then Rama says, "What difference does it make if this Rakshasa is good or wicked? Nobody can hurt me in the slightest way." But then he says, "Even at the cost of his own life, a righteous man must protect a fugitive from the enemy, no matter if he be arrogant or in abject misery. I give him my protection, whether it is Vibhishana or Ravana himself." There's very much that sense of alignment among the Rakshasas in that, like, good people tend to recognize each other in the Ramayana. But Vibhishana is not like some weirdo. There's another one of the Rakshasas who's keeping, or Rakshasis, I should say, who's keeping Sita prisoner, and she also feels sympathy for her captive and actually tries to help her. So even though the Rakshasas are demons, isn't necessarily the case that they're all bad. Now, this opens the door for the DM's nightmare, that is to say, sympathetic Rakshasas, or indeed, player character Rakshasas. To do that, you'd have to redefine what it means to be a Rakshas. You're not going to say, like, "Oh, you're a player character, and you have a cool racial ability, you're immune to spells below 8th level." But you could definitely have, you know, I guess that would be, you know, a tiefling or whatever, something like that in modern D&D, but whose ancestry was specifically Rakshas. Because there's definitely this sense that, you know, they're not, like, they tend to have, like, an inclination toward being bad, but they still make individual choices. They're responsible for their actions. And there are ones among them who are attracted to the path of right conduct, who are honorable and generous and, you know, don't agree with their leader's injustice. And some of them are able to kind of just walk away, and others are just kind of like, "Well, you know, I don't like this, but I have to put up with it, but I'll try to help in whatever small way that I can." So the Rakshas kind of stands as a symbol of greediness and inequality and tyranny generally, right? The Rakshas would be a tyrant if it could, and if it's a small-scale Rakshas, then it is, you know, a bully and a thief and a con artist. It just takes advantage of others. But it's not trapped by its nature. There are good ones, which means that they have made choices. And this just sort of symbolically represents the same thing about humans, right? I mean, the Rakshas lying to people to get its way or using force and intimidation to get its way is just kind of a large-scale projection of the fact that people do this all the time as well. I feel like what the Rakshas allows you to do is take the kind of evil of a demon, but then bring it into a more manageable, a more human locale, right? So even though Ravana is a supernatural creature, he wants stuff that's very relatable. He just wants wealth and power and luxury and... you know, he's genuinely in love with Sita, if that is a meaningful thing to say about him. He wants her, and he's just not a good person, so he's going to use force and trickery and whatever to try and get her to marry him. At one point, for example, he tries to persuade her that Rama is dead. So I feel like that's a lot more relatable than just like a demon or a devil, which tend to be kind of ideologically committed to concepts of abstract evil. A Rakshas is evil, or at least behaves in an evil way, but for reasons that are much more understandable, that it just wants kind of wealth and luxury and power, and it just has better means than most of getting them by hurting others. This, coincidentally, also means that it has some kind of palace full of, you know, hangings and jewels and rare incenses and different areas like a zoo and a pleasure garden and all other kinds, you know, like a menagerie, you know, full of exotic creatures and a pleasure garden with like a hedge maze and all kinds of bodyguards and concubines and court astrologers and whatever, which is to say a dungeon, like a really cool dungeon that it lives in, like a fancy, luxurious dungeon full of treasure. So it's a great monster which provides both a good antagonist for rascally PCs because it's got all kinds of wealth and, you know, portable goods that you want to get your hands on, or virtuous PCs who may decide that, you know, they want to take down the tyrant that is squeezing the life out of the peasants, and they're going to have to, you know, infiltrate his base and assassinate him in order to get his various ministers and generals fighting against each other. It's particularly good when you think that description of Ravana's might aside, the Rakshas isn't something that keeps its followers in line by brute force. It does it by trickery and manipulation. So you kind of want to get to this kind of, you'd almost have this kind of castle of illusions kind of a bit where all things might not be as they seem in the castle of a Rakshas. You'd have to make up a lesser form of Rakshasa, but there are lots of other smaller demons with illusion powers that I think would make excellent servitors, and there's no reason that it couldn't have an army full of, you know, hobgoblins or whatever. I feel like there's a lot of possibilities there with the Rakshasa. Anyway, I hope that's a slightly better dive into the mythology of the Rakshas. Like, there's so much folklore and there's so many stories about them that I realize I've only really focused on one, which is their appearance in the Ramayana, but I also feel that that kind of gives you an idea of the role that the Rakshasas play. And just to be specific, I've been using the Penguin edition, the Ramayana, which was translated by Arshia Sattar. It's, you know, it's on Amazon or whatever, and it's not hard to get a hold of. The only thing that the danger I feel in the Rakshas is that it does sort of play into some kind of Orientalist stereotypes, right? It's just so easy when you want like a cat villain to have him, you know, lounging on some silken cushions and, you know, puffing away on his hookah and all that stuff. And then a bunch of, you know, more conventionally kind of Western themed guys come in all, you know, grubby and righteous, and they strike him down with their long swords and then go off to quaff ale in taverns. And you're like, you know, like it's such a cool set of imagery, but as long as we're not kind of playing into, you know, the usual ancient and medieval stereotypes about the decadent East that were then, such attraction to like 18th and 19th and even 20th century authors. I think you need to be a little bit cautious there not to paint the Rakshas as sort of representative of the culture that it's from. Because, of course, I mean, they are portrayed that way in the Ramayana, but I think they're not portrayed that way as like, oh, you know, the soft East. It's so mysterious and clouded with incense. You just want to be a little bit on the lookout for that. Anyway, that's the Rakshasa. Pretty great monster. As you can see, I just selected a few pieces from the Ramayana, but there's a lot of good stuff out there, a lot of great Rakshasa art. I went to the Ramayana exhibit at the British Library many years ago now, and just lots of fantastic images from various, you know, editions of the Ramayana. I'll see if I can find some to put up for the art in this episode, because really just are terrific. So I hope that that's been a fun look at the Rakshas in a little bit more detail, and maybe one day I will do that episode about Mind Flayers. In the meantime, thank you to Dave Noonan for choosing and sponsoring this episode. Thank you to everyone who supports Monster Man on Patreon, and thank you for listening. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have someone you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.